gun cotton of T.E. Lawrence in the campaign in the Middle East to destroy the Hejaz Railway. And in the 1960s, a group of private contractors were resurveying the route of the Hejaz Railway, and they came across an old Turkish railway defence fort. In it, they found some explosive satchels, and in it, some unused explosive. And stamped on the outside of the satchel, RGPF, Royal Gunpowder Factory. So we know, we have a physical evidence that Waltham Abbey gun cotton went from here, down the Lee, to London docks, to a military depot, out to the Middle East, probably ended up on the back of a camel, ultimately to T.E. Lawrence, who used it to attack Turkish positions on the Hejaz Railway, and we have actual physical evidence of that. I'm Les Tucker, the archivist of the Royal Gunpowder Mills at Waltham Abbey. Now, can you imagine the superintendent culture, 1914, gentleman, Edwardian, senior military technologist soldier, everything running smoothly with about 600 disciplined male staff, and all of a sudden, Armageddon, World War I, and he's sitting there, and all of a sudden he's got to transform his entire mental outlook to an entirely, massively increased requirement, and coming later, fundamentally change nature of the staff. So a lot to expect. This was Colonel Fisher. What he was confronted with was Whitehall. And the people in Whitehall suddenly realised that they needed to turn the tap. They needed massively increased explosive. But the idea was they could just turn the tap overnight by sending a contract down to poor old Colonel Fisher, who was confronted with a leap from 26 tonnes output in 1913 to a demand for about initially 150. Overnight, he was supposed to just produce this from existing staff. In 1916, conscription is reduced in the outside world. Problem, male staff. What do we do? Recruit females. So overnight again, culture, poor old Colonel Fisher was called on to recruit what ultimately became 3,000 females, never been seen before on the site, all totally untrained, and he was able to cope with it. And if you can imagine the organisational strain this must have put to create the training system for these females, to have the staff available, but he did manage to increase the males willy-nilly to almost exactly equal 3,000 again. The numbers are, before the war, all male virtually, you can reckon on about 600 it reached. It fluctuated. Boer War, it went up a bit and then fell back a bit. But 1913, 600 roughly. By 1917, about 2,000 males and about possibly the same number of females. By the end of the war, and we've got an accurate number for this, total staff was 6,200. And of that, we know it virtually 50-50, 3,000 of each. That's from an original pre-war figure of 600. Females weren't employed in what were considered the more dangerous points. So they weren't in cordite mixing, they weren't in any way in the acid plants and one or two other so-called danger buildings, they weren't. So they were more operating the railways, heavy work, the boiler house stokers, very important, work like that, but not the really dangerous aspects. The interesting thing is that the mills had explosions before the war, Not after the war until, unfortunately, 1940, they had two bad ones. But during World War One, staff increased by 10 times, half of them totally untrained, if not more, not one fatality. Skylarking was forbidden. People could maybe have companionship, but you didn't skylark. And you also didn't run or move at a fast pace. They say you could always tell explosives workers going to lunch because you could see them marching at a very slow, steady pace on the way to the canteen. But this was all safety, what they tried to imbue it into people, and still do, I'm sure, in health and safety. Whatever was required of the mills, they did successfully. And I think this is symptomatic of them. Right the way through their history, they've had an underlying philosophy of very high quality standards and development of machinery and so on. They major change to the power technologies, steam and then hydraulic later on. Again, they reacted and adapted successfully. And again, the major change during the chemical revolution, where the whole character and fundamentals of the product and the operating setup changed. All the way through, if one looks at the history of the mills, they adapted successfully, major achievement, and yet probably totally, almost totally unremarked and unknown. We often get at the mills the argument that we shouldn't be preserving as a heritage centre a site which basically created destruction. But I think we have to look far beyond that. Explosives were very much split into civil and military, and the civil had a wide variety of uses, some of them absolutely essential, I mean, ranging from paints, pharmaceuticals, civil explosives, infrastructure explosives, and so on. We have to consider that as man has progressed through history, we have been threatened very severely. Two very major conflicts where, I mean, you can argue our civilization was threatened. The people at the mills regarded their function as providing the best possible way to the British servicemen of stopping them. And they did stop them, and they did stop them in the best possible way. So we regard that as an essential part of the country's history. You can't isolate it and say, oh, weren't you awful producing instruments of destruction?